Shakespeare's unpredictable fantasy now is set into motion. And Samuel Beckett's avant-garde tragicomic tale, may not seem to be a likely partnership. But today on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, we check in with both brilliant interpretations and creations. Endgame by Samuel Beckett is produced by Particle Theater Company, and it explores four characters in search of the ability to see and the ability to stand, while the others struggle within the world with no sea, no clouds, no sun. Of course, it's a bit more complicated than that. But Jim Benner, who stars as Ham in the production, is here in the studio sitting and waiting eagerly to complete this game of spiritual chess. And offered at Muhlenberg College Theater and Dance Department, The Winter's Tale by William Shakespeare, a play with real spirit of experimentation and rebelliousness, is offered to us by actor, director, professor of theater, acting, and voice and speech, Troy Dwyer. And I can assure you, you are now definitely tuned in to WDIY 88.1 in Allentown. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon, and I remain George Miller, and along with my wife and co-host Kate Scuffle, we are chatting today with Professor Dwyer, who is the director of the production of Winter's Tale, highlighting more of it, which opens, incidentally, on November the 20th. And we're chatting with Jim Benner, an actor, an administrator, a teacher, who stars in Endgame. It's opening December the 6th. At the Fox Environmental Center at Ilick's Mill, and he will tell us of other plays and of Particle Theater Company, created and directed by Norman Roberts. Troy, welcome.
Thanks, George. Yeah. It's good to be here.
With no further ado. So we were talking a little bit earlier before. I said the best talk is always right before the show.
Yeah, it is. We should put that.
We almost forgot to come on the air.
Microphone out there.
We were talking about A Winter's Tale, which is a late Shakespeare. Yeah. And George, you had said that John Lithgow's father, in fact, when you had been working with him, always would say it was a problem play. This is a problem play.
I don't know if he had a problem with
it. And before we kind of talk, I want to talk about the adaptation and your take on it. For our audience, give us a little bit of a sense of kind of the sense of A Winter's Tale, why people might be taken aback or find it difficult.
Yeah, it's paced differently and put together differently than, you know, movies and TV, all the stuff that we've cut our teeth on as spectators. It's really two plays in one. I mean, you spend the first half in the Kingdom of Sicilia, which is a kind of elegant and autumnal place, and then you come back after intermission and you're in this kind of wild, rural, clown-dotted, zippy, romantic, summery place. And so it feels like you've woken up in a completely different dimension when you come back. And it's geographically weird. I mean, you cross countries. There's a 16-year separation between the first act and the second act. And so it's not time-bound in a way that I think we're used to experiencing stories on stage.
Now, your take on it, too, though, which is interesting, talking about power, about couples, about marriages and all of that. Yeah. And the resonance, you found the way it kind of felt for you. Could you talk a little bit about the take on it, the casting, what intrigues you about the piece, what you're finding in it with the students?
Sure. You know, I as someone who teaches Shakespeare in performance and classical acting, and as someone who's done a lot of Shakespeare and classicism, you wrestle with the kind of cultural import of Shakespeare. People look up to Shakespeare as being the kind of pinnacle of the canon, really important dramatic literature. And as a young artist, I would often look to those stories to find the greatness. We're taught that that's where it is. But I'm also a queer artist. I'm a gay man. And very rarely, if ever, did I see myself in that way reflected back at me in those great stories. And so once I became a professional theater artist and started creating this work myself, I became really invested in finding ways to reflect me and my people, gay men and lesbians and transgendered people, back to audiences so we can see ourselves in those great stories. So I've taken a couple of the roles that are usually played by men, written to be played by men, and I've turned them into women's roles, which has given us some same-sex pairings in The Winter's Tale, where we usually don't see them. And it's given us an opportunity to ask some new questions about who has a right to marriage, what marriage is, especially now with the overturn of the Defense of Marriage Act in June. And, you know, I have a partner who's a man, Will Morris, who's the technical director at the Civic Theater of Allentown. And thinking about marriage in Pennsylvania being two men is something that's been part of our, you know, dinner table conversation more and more now. How do we do that now that it's easier to do that at the national level? And so it seemed ripe. The time seemed ripe to reflect that back in art in a way that also allows us to, you know, knock about with clowns and on stage and have fun.
And what does that do in terms of does change the sense of the play for you in terms of, I mean, is it it's still an exploration of partnering, of marriage,
of power.
You know.
I think that it's one of the things that it's brought forward is a different flavor of what's sexy about the pairings. We've taken the role of Florizel, who is, in the original context of the play, the prince of Bohemia, the young prince who flees the palace and goes out into the rurals and falls in love with a young shepherdess. Later, she's revealed to be a princess who didn't know she was a princess, of course, because, you know, that's Shakespeare. So their relationship in the original context had some taboos to it across class. Princes and shepherdesses don't mix. But those resonances are more dilute in 2013. The way we think about class, the way we think about, you know, family of origin is different. And when we assigned a woman's body to Florizel and made Florizel a woman, not a man, all of a sudden we got new, more contemporary resonances for why a child would flee a family in order to be himself or herself. And as we played the love scenes between Florizel and Perdita, we found that some of the more cultish, rollicking masculine sexual impulses that were layered into the language all of a sudden started to parody themselves. And we started to find ways to poke fun at some of the assumptions about what's authoritative about male sexuality. And so the young woman playing Florizel, Kelly Ansley, who's a wonderful Muhlenberg student, acting student from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, finds that she's sending up maleness quite a bit as she mocks and makes fun of the kind of male lover role that she has to play in a way that actually lightens it, brightens it, and makes the sexual play between the two of them feel frisky and fun. It's a fresher, it's a less of a stale love story. And I think that no matter how you're wired, I found that as we've had people sitting in on the rehearsals, everyone is kind of smirking and their eyebrows are going up and they're looking around and blushing. It feels fun in that way. And what a yummy way to spend the evening.
Absolutely.
You know, just to have a little spring in your step when you walk out of the theater.
And of course, you don't have to answer this, but I wonder who plays the bear.
Everyone asks about the bear, man. Everyone wants to know about
he hunts victims, does he not?
The bear hunts victims. Well, you know, Exit Pursued by a Bear is one of the most famous pieces of Shakespeare, and it's not even dialogue. It's a stage direction because he gives you no other information about how to take care of that at all. So it's a lovely mystery, but I am very proud of our bear. The bear is a beautiful moment.
So these two kingdoms are really intertwined with a really bitter prophecy that hangs over the whole play.
We're led to believe that the king of Sicilia, Leontes, in some ways curses both his kingdom and an associate kingdom because of his jealous madness. He enrages the gods, and it sets a series of events into motion that have to do with, you know, princesses who don't know that they're shepherdesses and in our world, some sapphic love before everything is resolved magically, maybe, at the end.
I understand, too, that one of the really innovative things here that has been done is you've worked with a choreographer and original score person. That's, I think, Allison Berger, is it?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And Sean.
Sean Scahill.
Yeah. So how is that like working with the...
A gift.
Because they're students.
They're students. Yeah. These are students. Yeah. I'm blessed. I mean, students come from all over the country. Art students come from all over the country to go to Muhlenberg. We're really lucky to have a wealth of very talented young people around us. And they're eager to do something. And I had worked with Sean a little bit in a production I had artistic directed last year, and I knew him to be this. He's young. I mean, he's a junior. At the time he was a sophomore, to be this brilliant young musician who could just dash off compositions immediately. And so he's also quite a good actor. So I approached him about maybe working with me. And then he auditioned for the play after we started writing music. And I realized that he would be a great Autolycus, who is the kind of rogue and minstrel figure.
Okay.
So Sean plays his own music on his guitar with a small ensemble of students. And what he has created is professional strength music. I mean, he would be saleable in this way in the professional world, absolutely. And there's no way that we would be able to afford to pay a musician of that caliber elsewise. And so, and what it's brought to the play is enormous. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it breathes with passion. Allie Berger is, I've worked with her several times before. She was in a production of The Tempest I directed a couple of years ago with Charles O. Anderson, who is longtime collaborator of mine. He's the artistic director of Dance Theater X and a former Muhlenberg faculty member. And Allie is this wonderful dancer and composer. And we just get each other, Allie and I. And so I can look at her and sort of make hand motions, and then she'll go in and work with a company. It'll come back exactly right. So it has this really professional gloss to it that is, I think, so rare for college theater. It's an unusual thing to see.
You did bring up Dance Theater X, and I understand that you are the playwright in residence there, and you're doing a new piece. Is that right?
Yeah. We're premiering Restless Natives in Austin, Texas. Charles Anderson now teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. So that premieres in April. Mm-hmm. And it's based on the novel Another Country by James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And uses the talents of a poet and recording artist, Ursula Rucker, who's Philadelphia-based. Charles and I have worked with her several times before. So it's a dance theater, a post-race post-sexuality epic. Mm-hmm. We've been workshopping it for the past year. So
that's great.
I should remind people before we'll get caught up here, the Winter's Tale is actually running November 20th through the 24th in the Studio Theater at the Trexler Pavilion for Theater and Dance at Muhlenberg. Just to know, that's Wednesday through Friday at 8, Saturday at 2 and 8, Sunday at 2. Go to muhlenberg.edu and find the Theater and Dance and get your tickets. But it's interesting because we were like, okay, Beckett, Winter's Tale. But I thought it was something, and we'll talk more about this when we're discussing Endgame, the sense of telling stories and theatricality and kind of breaking down. What you were saying, it's not TV, it's not movies, it's not the way we kind of package our stories today. And sometimes it occurs to me with all the technology and the TV and the movies, it makes us need something like Winter's Tale more than when it was written.
Yeah, it becomes a ritual. I think something happens in good performance. I think it happens in good Shakespeare. It certainly happens in good Beckett when the audience becomes very aware of itself and becomes very aware that the bodies on the stage are real humans just like them, and that you're breathing the same air, and that the event that you're seeing in front of you is, if it's being felt by the actors, is not necessarily fictive. It's felt by the bodies. I mean, you know, those of us who do theater know that this is true. The things that can be created on stage can be every bit as real as what happens in the quote-unquote real world. Just the circumstances are imaginary. We can break that. We can walk away. You know, we can go out to the bar afterwards with our fellow actors and decompress and talk about what that is. And that's that close to the moment freshness, the smell of the sweat and the recognition that the humanity is in the space is real. And no, we don't get that from film. Film does its own thing.
TV
does its own thing. And we can probe imaginative spaces in different ways. But the ritual, people coming together in a darkened space around candlelight or something like that, that's reaches into parts of humanity that I think sometimes in the digital age do get neglected. And so, you know, it gets us back to the bear. I mean, the bear is a scary monster in The Winter's Tale. Does it have to be a bear? Do we have to bring in, you know, a bear from the zoo in order to make that happen? Well, maybe if we did film, we might, right?
Right. Yeah.
But
right.
we might find that the monster that gets into that hard-to-reach place inside the body, the ritual place, is made up of different stuff.
Yeah.
And you can get to it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
he's being very careful because you know
all the time.
He forgot my name on the air last week, so we're still handling that. No, but thank you, because I was going to say the piece, much like much of Shakespeare, could also be a 5-hour piece.
Oh, yes,
now
it can.
Yours is not.
No, it's not. It's 2 hours.
We have to make some concessions too, but sadly. But yeah, that sense of heightened sharing the space, but also just the magicalness, I think. Film maybe can approach that at times, I think. But again, in a different way.
Yeah. No, I think we remember our humanity very often.
Trey Dwyer, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to The Winter's Tale at Muhlenberg, and I hope all of you are as well. It's going to be a fantastic production. I'm sure. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Kate. Thanks.
We shall be right back after this enchanting discussion, actually, of theatrical wonders, after this really salient message.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater, presenting Christmas City Follies, Thursday, December 5th through the 22nd at Touchstone Theater. A Bethlehem holiday tradition, this Touchstone Theater Ensemble created classic yet again reimagines what the holidays are all about with music, wit, and holiday hijinks. For information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org. For program support on WDIY, we thank Allentown Symphony Association, presenting the National Theater and the 2010 return encore broadcast of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Rory Kinnear plays Hamlet in a new production of Shakespeare's complex and profound play, Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m. at Miller Symphony Hall. For information, millersymphonyhall.org.
We have been chatting with Troy Dwyer of Muhlenberg, the College Theater and Dance Department, in The Winter's Tale. And now we're going to be talking with Dr. Jim Benner of Particle Theater Company and Northampton Community College. And we welcome you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking, it's interesting with Endgame. I said earlier I had found the original Brooks Atkinson 1959 review online and researching this, and it's so funny because he's kind of like, it's that thing of like, he's like, oh, you know, Beckett's a genius. And like, I've got to, like Shakespeare, I've got to take this series, I've got to, you know, review it. But you could tell it kind of scared him, and that he acknowledged the power of it because it did scare him, if that makes sense.
I think some of what Troy was just talking about, I think, comes across in Beckett in perhaps even more direct ways, maybe. You feel as if the thing is happening right in front of you, that it's supposed to happen. this isn't what I normally see in a play. And I think that breaking of a lot of the rules of storytelling and yet making storytelling the sort of center of the play keeps the thing jumping and moving all the time. Our play is probably going to be somewhere between 75 and 90 minutes long. It's a one act. It's a longish one act. But it's full of so many dips and dives and moves and shifts. And as the title indicates, Endgame, it's kind of like a, if you like, a sort of chess game, constant moves, especially by the two main characters. But it's happening, and the length of the play is the length of the experience. In other words, you don't have the sort of breaks in the narrative so that it's 10 years earlier or 3 years later or any of that. It's what's happening during
right
that
now.
Time is what's happening. And so that's a little confrontational, I guess, in a way, for some folks, yeah.
And it's for folks that might be more or less familiar, four characters who in one way or another are both dependent on each other, in some ways crippled in a kind of post-apocalyptic feel. I mean, it was written after World War II.
Right.
As you had mentioned, Beckett was a fighter with the French Resistance, all of that kind of war. And that's that element of us had
Absolutely.
Been, you know, a strong influence. But Norman Roberts, who's directing, I find it fascinating. You said that a constant question that comes up in the rehearsal is, where's the hope?
That's right. Well, I think that one of the things that's central, I think, to understanding something like Beckett, I think, is, and people always assume, oh, he's dark, he's depressing, da-da-da. I think he is, this play in particular is, the hope is not in the play, as it were. It's not something a character says or does to make things work out. Instead, it's what we might do after the play. That is what we, the audience, take from it and think, how do I live differently? And it would be also ridiculous in a way for Beckett to have a story that resolved itself, since the play is so much about the idea of controlling the narrative or controlling the story. My character, Ham, and Clove in particular, were always trying to take charge of the story of the play, and we keep trying to wrest control from each other. I think Beckett is playing with that need that we all have to control the story of our own lives and very often the lives of others. And it's that need for the control of the story causes so much of our anguish. And so maybe if we recognize some of that, we might back off. And as Norman says, be more interested in trying to understand the world we're actually in than trying to make it fit a story that makes sense. Norman is where the phrase he likes to use is, I'm more interested in delving deeply into why things are happening, not coming up with a story that tells us the answer. So I think that's very much what this play is about.
It's interesting because that would seem to be reflected in the way you've been rehearsing it, mm-hmm. which would be the envy of many, I think, an actor and director, and it's usually finances, particularly in this country, that hold us back from it. But you're meeting weekly,
yes.
Is that correct? Once
yes.
a week?
Once a week. We started in February. We had a couple of breaks because of people's personal lives and sure. plans, but we're meeting in my home in our living room, and we've been meeting since February, and we meet a good 3-4 hours when we do, but we do just once a week. We'll have a couple of extra right before when we actually are in the physical space where we're doing the show at the Fox Environmental Center, but we've done all the rehearsals in that other space, and it's given us a chance to for things to percolate and marinate and whatever other gustatory metaphor you want to think about, but it really has allowed us, I think, to delve deeply into some of the meanings. The play is full of very strange exchanges that don't seem to follow a kind of narrative logic and what right. we're used to yes. when we go to the theater.
Yeah.
And so those are challenges for the actors, but the way we rehearsed it gave us all kinds of space to do that exploration.
It's good. Now, you're playing the role of Ham, of course.
I am, yes.
And I know of one other actor in the play, John Hopwood, who yes. Is a good friend of ours in theater.
Oh,
and
good.
Who are the other two people?
John is playing Nag,
yeah. yes.
My older father, mm-hmm. who's living in a can. And my mother is played by Jen Santos.
Oh, yes.
And that's Nell. And then the other major play actor is Steve Posavec, and he's playing Clove. My servant, my laborer, my slave, who knows what my dog, my son, he's many things to me.
Well, it's interesting drawing the parallels again in The Winter's Tale that we were talking about, the kind of power plays or power things of marriage
right.
and of coupling. Traditionally, Ham would be considered to be the kind of overriding heavyweight of the play.
Yep.
Poor Clove kind of serving that. Sounds like you and the cast have been exploring letting that power move around a little more
Absolutely.
Between the characters than we might often see
Absolutely.
In a production.
Absolutely. And remember, Ham is also a Ham actor, and so there's a fair amount of comedy in this play, which most people, again, don't think Beckett right away, don't
no.
think. There's a fair amount of that in this, and I hope it works, and we're really working on that. Not to make it funny make it funny,
right.
but to discover the comic in the absurd relationships there. But to go back to your point, yeah, it's when you start exploring the play and the actual moment-to-moment exchanges, Ham is not in charge all the time. And even at times maybe doesn't want to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a game for him, an end game, as it were. And the question is, do I keep living? Do I not keep living? And how does this other character keep that going? And who is really in charge, as it were? By the end of the play, let the audience decide, but I think it'll be more complicated. The answer is more complicated than it must be Ham, because he's the
sure,
he's
yeah.
the apparent king sitting in a
yeah,
throne-like
yeah.
setting and
mm-hmm.
giving all kinds of orders.
I'm wondering, with the extended rehearsal period, the weekly, over the months, have you found yourself, has it affected your world? I mean, it's a brilliant mind, a brilliant playwright to mm. kind of live with for mm. months. Has it affected yeah. the way you go about your daily life? That kind of shadow of this thing?
Yeah, I think I go back and forth. There's a part of me that isn't as purist as I should be, I suppose, in that I look forward to the production. But on the other hand, I love the rehearsal process
yeah.
so much that seeing it come to an end as we approach the opening, I'm a little sad about that. But, you know, people say, I don't want to live with Ham from the rest of friends of mine and so forth. And so, yeah, and you can't help start being doing some of that in your daily life. And it's not like you're trying to be a method actor
right,
or anything
right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
It's just the natural kind of, and you start listening, actually, to people's dialogue and to their exchanges, and you start hearing echoes of the play, and it's kind of hard not to see the play and the theater kind of living together.
We just want to remind our listeners that Endgame is playing at the Fox Environmental Center. That's 100 Ilex Mill Road, Bethlehem. You know, it's Ilex Mill. That's what it is. It's December 6th and the 7th at 7:30, December the 11th at 1 p.m., and December 12th and 13th at 7:30. Tickets reservations can be had by calling 484-241-8022. 484-241-8022.
And again, that's Particle Theater in their third production after having done Beauty Queen of Lanann and
the play about the baby, by Edward Albee.
Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. And we must say special thanks to Steve Aronson, our resident keeper of the clouds, the sun, the radio vibrations, which reach your home every day. Thank you, Steve, for controlling this radio broadcast and for keeping our hosts, Kate and I, out of harm's way for more than 4 years. I thank you. I looked at my calendar. You've been doing this for us for 4 years. Thank you. Exit pursued by a bear. Thanks all for being with us, and thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, at the movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of The Press.
12 Years a Slave is a profound film depicting an era of unspeakable horror in the history of the United States. As with this year's Lee Daniels' The Butler, the point of view of 12 Years a Slave is that of a director of color, Great Britain's Steve McQueen, who previously directed Shame and Hunger. McQueen brings an unblinking perspective and a certain calm detachment to the material. 12 Years a Slave is paced by the performance of Chiwetel Ejiofor, whose interior-driven, thoughtful, and remarkable performance is that of Solomon Northup. The film is based on Northup's memoir, believed to be published in 1854 with some 30,000 copies sold. Chiwetel Ejiofor is a certain Oscar actor nominee. 12 Years a Slave, which has depictions of wince-inducing violence, has an eloquence in dialogue and atmospheric landscapes. Look for Oscar nominations for picture, director, McQueen, adapted screenplay, McQueen and John Ridley, score, Hans Zimmer, cinematography, Sean Bobbitt, and several supporting actor and actress nominations. Solomon Northup was a free black man married with two children living in Saratoga, New York. Northup, a vibrant speaker, friendly gentleman, and an accomplished violinist, was asked to join a traveling circus-type show when he was kidnapped, apparently in Washington, D.C. What unfolds in 12 Years a Slave is told partly with skillful flashbacks by director McQueen. Solomon Northup is placed on a slave ship and taken to New Orleans, where he's sold at a slave auction presided over by a slave trader, ironically named Freeman, played by Paul Giamatti, to a seemingly sympathetic plantation master, Ford, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, where he gets on the wrong side of the slave overseer, Tibbetts, played by Paul Dano, who lives up to his ironic slave-beating name. Northup is resold to another plantation owner, Edwin Epps, played by Michael Fassbender, who should also garner an Oscar supporting actor nomination. Epps has a cruel obsession with a young slave girl, Patsy, played by Lupita Nyong, who also deserves an Oscar actress nomination in her film debut. In smaller roles in 12 Years a Slave are Alfre Woodard as Mr. Shaw and Brad Pitt, a producer of the film, as Bass, a Canadian abolitionist. 12 Years a Slave is a remarkable film that should be seen by students of history, young and old. 12 Years a Slave is MPAA rated R, for violence, cruelty, some nudity, and brief sexuality. Opening November 22, The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Jennifer Lawrence is back in the title role as Katniss Everdeen. That's all you need to know. Oh, and yes, the plot has something to do with Katniss Everdeen and Peeta Mellark becoming targets of the Capitol after their winning the 74th Hunger Games in the first film. Their win foments a rebellion in the districts of Panem. There may also be a riot in the districts of movie critics with this plot. Oh, you should also know that Josh Hutcherson is back as Peeta Mellark. Also starring in the sci-fi action film based on the sensationally popular Susan Collins young adult novels are Stanley Tucci, Woody Harrelson, Donald Sutherland, Elizabeth Banks, Liam Hemsworth, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Jeffrey Wright, Amanda Plummer, and Lenny Kravitz. I'm Paul Willistein of the Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.